AFRS Sports Reel. This is the AFRS Sports Reel. Yes, sports fans, gather around at Old 19th Hole. Here's another yarn session with three of your favorite commentators on the sporting life: Sam Valter, Ed Thargerson, and Bill Stern. For our first close-up, here's Bill Stern to pass on to you the strangest baseball story he's ever heard.
This is the strangest baseball story I've ever heard. For this is a story, as told to me, of three men who once roomed together. And yet, strangely enough, all three of these roommates had a curious interest in the game of baseball. These three roommates were very poor. So poor that back at the turn of the century, in 1900, these three men occupied a cheap room on 15th Street, west of Broadway in New York City. A room that didn't even have a window in it. Yet it was the best room that these three roommates could afford. The first of these three roommates was a man named Henry Howard. Years later, was the same Henry Howard who, according to the story, was destined to organize one of the strangest baseball teams in America. A baseball team that still plays baseball in St. Petersburg, Florida. And it's such an unusual team that last year, the Saturday Evening Post wrote a feature article about this team that had been founded by Henry Howard. For you see, this strange baseball team last year played before more than 100,000 people, despite the fact that every man on that team has to be over 75 years old. That's the story of the first of these three roommates who roomed together in New York City back in 1900. The second of these three roommates was a man named Sweeney, Fred Sweeney. And he, too, loved baseball. Loved it so much that he, too, reputedly organized a baseball team. In fact, Fred Sweeney organized two baseball teams. Two baseball teams that are made up of good players. So good that some of these players on Fred Sweeney's team should be in the major leagues. And yet no player on his teams has ever received a major league offer. And no player on his team will ever get a major league offer. Because, you see, Sweeney and his baseball teams live on a small island off the coast of France. And each member of his teams is a convicted killer serving life sentences for murder. Now you know the story of the second of these three men who once roomed together in New York City. But the story of their third roommate is even stranger. For unlike his other two roommates, this third roommate did not like the game of baseball. His name was Jack Norwood. And whenever his two roommates would bring up the subject of baseball, Jack Norwood would laugh at him. They tried their best to get him interested in the game, but he just didn't like baseball. The more his two roommates tried to interest him in baseball, the more he began to dislike the game. Until finally, Jack Norwood admitted to his roommates that he hated the game of baseball. And yet, strangely enough, this same Jack Norwood, who hated the game of baseball, will never be forgotten as long as baseball is played. For even though he didn't like the game, it was he who wrote baseball's greatest song, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game."
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
That's the story of three roommates who once roomed together in New York City. Three men who've had a strange influence on the game of baseball. For the first of these roommates, Henry Howard organized a baseball team in St. Petersburg, Florida, where every player on that team has to be 75 years old. And the second roommate, Fred Sweeney, organized two baseball teams, and to play on his teams, you've got to be a killer convicted of murder. But the most interesting story of these three roommates was the story of the third roommate, Jack Norwood. Jack Norwood, who despite the fact that he didn't even like the game of baseball, was destined to make baseball history by writing baseball's greatest song. But that's not the end of the story of these three roommates. Oh, no. The strangest part of this story is the incredible fact, strange as it seems, that Jack Norwood, who didn't like baseball and yet wrote baseball's greatest song, has never seen a game of baseball. In fact, he has never been
at the Oval.
great song.
Great Bill Stern, that was a strange story indeed. The biggest event in auto racing, and perhaps the most thrill-packed in the entire world of sport, is the annual Indianapolis Speedway. And here's Ed Thorgerson with a memorable moment from the Speedway.
At Indianapolis, 24 cars and 24 drivers started the grueling grind on that blistering hot Memorial Day 34 years ago. There was Teddy Tetzlaff in a Fiat, Bob Berman in a Cutting, David Bruce Brown, Howdy Wilcox, and Joe Dawson all in shining Nationals. Huey Hughes was driving a yellow Mercer with wire wheels, a revolutionary development in those days. Spence Wishart, Ab Jenkins, Ralph Mulford, Eddie Hearn, Wild Bill Endicott, and Gil Anderson were in there in such assorted races as a Stutz, McFarlane 6, Case, Simplex, Marquette Buick, Lexington, and Opel. At the wheel of a red Firestone Columbus sat a tall, skinny kid named Eddie Rickenbacker. But the man to beat that day was Ralph DePalma in his gray Mercedes, a beautiful car machined with the precision of a Swiss watch and tuned to make a fabulous 120 miles an hour on the straightaway. DePalma took the lead on the third lap, with Wishart and Bruce Brown fighting for the second position, and the others strung out around the track. The speed of the Mercedes was 83 miles an hour, 1 minute, 49 seconds for a complete circuit of the 2.5 mile brick-paved oval. One by one, the cars began to falter as the pace became too fast for overheated steel and rubber. On the sixth lap, Harry Knight's Lexington blew a cylinder. A connecting rod snapped on the opal. Two broken piston rings forced out Bruce Brown in the 25th lap. Rickenbacker's turn came on the 43rd, a crystallized valve. A burned-out crankshaft bearing washed up Eddie Hearn on the 55th. On the 63rd, the McFarlane 6 blew a tire and sheared off two wheels against the wall. In the 67th, a Case practically fell to pieces as it coasted into the pits. A Stutz careened wildly and leaped from the track. A connecting rod ripped through the crankcase of a big red Simplex. The carburetor of the Marquette Buick caught fire. Only 14 cars were still in the race at 200 miles, and DePalma was steadily adding to the lead he had taken in the first 5 minutes. Three more drivers gave up before the 300-mile mark was reached. Four-fifths through the race, DePalma was 7 full laps in front, 17 and a half miles in the lead. As he began the 197th lap, DePalma was 11 minutes ahead of Joe Dawson, who was trailing second. Only three laps, 7.5 miles, separated DePalma from victory and first prize money of $20,000. And then it happened. Off on the backstretch, one of the Mercedes' overstrained pistons snapped, and the smooth roar turned into a noisy clatter. As the car slowed and the other drivers raced ahead, DePalma's Mercedes sounded like a swing shift in a boiler factory, but he stayed in the race. Into the 199th lap, he crawled at 20 miles an hour. And then, on the home stretch, 80,000 spectators saw an unforgettable demonstration of raw courage. Joe Dawson had already crossed the finish line to win, and Tetzlaff had roared in second when the gray Mercedes came in sight around the turn. DePalma was pushing it, steering from the side and pushing it. As he inched the racer in front of the grandstand, the 80,000 could see the sweat pouring from his face and the terrible fatigue in every inch of his body. For a mile and a half, that massive car had been moved by nothing but DePalma's indomitable will to win a finish. For an instant, there was a stunned silence as the crowd looked, and then a mighty roar went up that shook the very foundations of the speedway. It was a tribute to a man who had not won, but to a man who had gained more in losing than in any of his victories. Yes, Ralph DePalma rode and pushed his way to glory because he proved how great a real sportsman can be, even in defeat.
That was swell, Ed. And now here's Sam Balter with a story about, I could be wrong, but I think it's about golf. Let's find out.
What goes to make a champion golfer? His lengthy wallop, his keen approach, a steady putter? Yes, of course. The skill of the man, surely. But sometimes more than that. Ask many a golfer about how the great Hague, Walter Hagen, won his matches, and they'll tell you, mind over matter, man. Half the time, it was mind over matter. Yes, he had the screaming drives, the masterful approach shots, but many times so did his opponent. And on these occasions when skill and technique were at a stalemate, psychology of the master entered the picture, and Walter Hagen won the tournament with his mind. Not possible? Well, since this would normally be the time of the annual PGA, consider the PGA tournament of 1927, for example. The last of Sir Walter's 5 PGA championships. Walter went on to the finals. His opponent, Joe Turnessa, and it was in this match that Hagen pulled what most pros consider his masterpiece. On the first green, Hagen and Ternesser were both on in three, and Hagen went down for his par four. Ternesser's ball was about 6 feet away. Now, a six-foot putt is not a difficult putt for professionals, but it's not too easy either when there's a great deal at stake. Ternesser had carefully lined up the putt, studied the line, walked over to the ball, when Hagen knocked the ball aside, conceding the putt. On the second green, he conceded an eight-footer to give Ternesser the hole. And so it went throughout the match, Hagen conceding all kinds of short putts. He was two down at the turn, but at the 18th green, they were all even. Walter holed out for a par. Ternesser had a beautiful approach that rolled up within 5 feet of the cup, likewise a certain par. Ternesser started to pick up his ball, and then, smiling sort of sheepishly, stopped himself. After all, that was against the rules. Then he looked at Hagen. Hagen was looking into space. Well, that was a funny thing. During the entire match, Hagen conceded any putt under 10 feet. Here was one half that long, but the Hagen appeared not to notice. He stood by, waiting respectfully for Ternesser to make his shot. Well, that was a heck of a note. Did Hagen imagine that he, Ternesser, was going to miss a putt like this? Then it came to Ternesser that he had actually not attempted to roll one into the cup itself all day. He had yet to hear the satisfying music of ball on tin as it kerplunked in its fall into the tin cup. All the shots had been conceded. Well, this was different. This going right into the cup instead of up close to it where it could be conceded. Yes, he had to be right on this one. He had to. By golly, the entire match depended on it, didn't it? Now Ternesser found himself shaking a little. He looked almost pleadingly toward Hagen. There must be a mistake. Had the Hague forgotten? This was only 5 feet, and Joe Ternesser waited. The Hague showed no expression. Like the spectators, he was waiting for Ternesser to run the ball down. Well, Joe had delayed long enough. It was time for him to putt. He walked toward the ball, a panic gripping him. He'd forgotten how to make a short putt. It was crazy, but he had. He'd had no practice at it, he told himself. Well, no need to go on. Joe Ternesser missed the putt. The match was over. And fellow pros walked away saying, "Yes, sir. Walter Hagen won the 1927 PGA Championship at Dallas, Texas with, no, not his putter or niblick or spoon, but with mind over matter." It was for the book.
Thank you, Sam Balter. And that, fans, winds up our sports reel for today. But don't forget to listen for our return with more close-ups by America's best-known sports authorities. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.